Hello and welcome to the second Music Business Worldwide podcast, supported by CI, who offer digital music delivery expertise, working with some of the biggest independent labels, distributors and aggregators in the world. Before we begin, I'd like to say thank you to our hosts, Tune Tribe Entertainment Group. Once again, we have an executive who offers some great expertise and some great experience of the music business. And this time he's travelled over the Atlantic for us. This executive has worked across some of the biggest names in the record industry, including Chrysalis, SBK, EMI and Artemis Records. Working with artists including Billy Idol, Sinead O'Connor, Blur, Arrested Development, Boy George and Warren Zevon. In 2007 he created his own company, Glassnote Entertainment Group, which now counts on its roster artists including Two Door Cinema Club, Phoenix, Mumford & Sons, and Childish Gambino. That gentleman is Daniel Glass. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
I mentioned some of the more established artists on Glassnote there. I was with you last night to check out Flo Morrissey in London. She was signed out of the UK. I believe Glassnote entered the UK in 2013. Is that correct?
Yes.
What are your plans on this side of the Atlantic? What are your ambitions?
Well, great to be here. It's nice to be in a room with The Who on the wall. First show I ever saw as a little boy. Two of the companies that I admire most as role models that I try and emulate almost every day of my life are Chrysalis and A&M. If you look at the history of Chrysalis, where I worked for 7 years in the 80s, all our artists had broken throughout the world, but it was such a tasteful presence in London. Mm-hmm. And that was a London-based company. A&M, the roots were in New York, moved to Los Angeles, and then established a presence in both London and Paris. We'll talk about that maybe in 5 years, but I felt that after talking to Jerry Moss particularly, who's one of my mentors and teachers, that we had to be here. And at a very casual dinner at Coachella a few years ago, Irving Azoff hosted us for this fabulous dinner. My son Sean was with me, and we went around the table. I've actually never told this story before. We ran around the table and saying, what are your aspirations for the next year? Very casual. Jeffrey Azoff was there, who has an amazing job now at CAA. My son Sean is doing amazing work as a DJ, entrepreneur, tech, and now with Apple and working with Larry and Jimmy at Connect. And my statement was then, this is now two and a half years ago, is we really want to become strong in the UK and Europe. And I need somebody to run it. I just can't find the person. So Zane Lowe was my guest at dinner. And Zane says, oh no, I've got the guy, but I don't want to lose him. But he really wants to work with someone like you. And that guy was Sam Rumney. So I met Sam, and it was love at first sight, and Sam agreed to join us.
I wanted to ask you about your patience with artists. That is certainly steeped in the traditions of A&M and Chrysalis that you've mentioned there. Do you think that you have the freedom or ability to be more patient with an artist's career than perhaps a major label with all of the firepower they have?
Well, we have complete autonomy of what we do. And patience is one of our top three virtues besides, I think, taste and focus and attention to detail. But I would say patience is probably our number one trait that differentiates us from both majors and maybe other independents. So I always look at the climb of Phoenix, 58 weeks of going inch by inch to the top of the alternative charts and then all the way to the Grammys and gold records. And now 58 weeks for me is like nothing. To me, it takes time. It takes time. So the majors, having been inside those companies, I don't think you have that luxury because the clock is always running. You've got to make certain numbers that we don't have to make. So I'm not under any financial controls or ownership. You've got to be in it as a partner to back the artist, which is why we care so much about the live. We stress live, live, live. And it's holding the hands. And if we see the audience getting larger, and it could be 12 more people, we are so happy for the artist. And we build upon that. So, we could talk about social media. We could talk about all the tricks and the bells and whistles. To me, it's the fans. If there's 15 more fans in the club, we did a good job mm-hmm. together. And then there's 30 more fans. And all of a sudden, somehow you got to the O2. Somehow you got to Glastonbury or to Bonnaroo or those places. So I think that's our job. As a company.
You mentioned Phoenix before. That was one of your big first success stories mm-hmm. as an independent. Before you got there, even, why did you leave that established record label world to do your own thing? And how do you remember the first few weeks and months of Glassnote's genesis?
Everybody has a time and a place to start. You've got a lot of, I don't know what you call them, walking cliches of executives that get fired from record companies. They get displaced or merged, and they say, I'm going to be an indie. You know, there's some exceptions. People like Christian Tattersfield, for example, I really admire. Because he always had an indie spirit. He was always doing his publishing thing, always doing his record thing, and he acted like an indie within a major. And I admire him. I actually admire the guy that took his job, Max Lusada, another guy who has an independent spirit. So, but for the most part, I was around independent labels, Chrysalis, SBK, Rising Tide, which Doug Morris and I started, which became Universal. And there comes a time when you either get bought, sold, merged, and then what do? You have to start over again. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to have a legacy. I wanted to feel that I could be there. Like Chris and Terry at Chrysalis, I remember them talking about Jethro Tull's 17th album. I'd like to be there one day for someone's 11th album and 11th, you know, worldwide tour. So that's why I did this, because I didn't want to feel that we were under the gun to merge or sell. I had seen it. Chrysalis did well when they sold. SBK did well. Rising Tide, you know, it unfurled into this amazing company called Universal, which I was proud of what we started, but it wasn't me. My DNA is independent. I mean, I married an independent's daughter. I married, you know, Sam Weiss's daughter. So to me, I just took a long time to get here. I think some people get it when they're 21 years old. It took me an extra, you know, 25 years to complete my education. And I'm not ashamed of that. And I think that's encouraging for anybody listening that it doesn't always happen in your teens or 20s. You know, I look at Sam and Jack, who have Disclosure and Sam Smith. You know, that's the aberration. That's the anomaly. That's I mean, those guys are amazing, but that's the exception. And lightning struck for them, you know, almost three times now with this great songwriter they have. So they're doing great. But for the most part, the long, hard road, whether it's rejection, whether it's failure, whether it's mistakes, or whether it's a lot of successes for other people, prepared me for opening the company. And my wife really gave that last zets, that last push to do this, and said, let's get some of our money out of the bank and never let this happen again. I was rewarded very well in my life. I didn't, you know, I don't want people to think that I was a pauper, but it was, you have to be ready. And it's very, very scary to do it when it's your own money and it's your and you're going in on your own. So I started with two laptops. That was it. We went to Apple and bought two laptops, and that's how it started.
And am I right? I think you didn't have an office for quite a while.
And not in the beginning, because I said, why do we need an office? And I saw some of my peers who were starting these labels with these fancy offices, and I said, they're not going to be in business. One guy had a desk that I couldn't believe. It was the most gorgeous desk in the world and these huge doors. I said, I'd rather have hit records. I'd rather have songwriters. So we started the company. We used to go to this Waldorf Astoria hotel, Chris Scully and I, who was the first guy that joined me. And we stayed there for a few months and had our meetings up there. What's interesting about the beginning of the company, no one ever asked, do you have an office? They would just come to the Waldorf Astoria. We'd meet until we were thrown out. We got escorted out once because people thought we were running a prostitution ring. Really? I asked the security guys, why can't we come back? He said, you guys are up to something. And so we left and we went to Barney's and we camped out at Fred's, this restaurant up there, and we borrowed the Wi-Fi and they were very nice. And then we were ready to open up a little office. It was four of us. So the office means nothing. Artists will never ask you about the size of your office or where your location is. They want to know, are you behind me? Are you with me? Do you support me? Can you get me the exposure? Do you believe in me? Are you going to be there for me on a rainy day? And that's who we are. And our first artist we signed was someone named Secondhand Serenade, and we went double platinum. We sold 2.3 million singles, first record in America. Our phones lit up. Every manager, every lawyer called us. And again, no office when we were doing that. So it's a great story and a great lesson for someone who's young who wants to start a company. We had nothing. We had no infrastructure. We just believed in Secondhand Serenade and got them all over the radio and got them on Conan O'Brien's show and everywhere. It was great.
Do you find yourself competing with the majors for acts? But secondly, could they offer anything that you can offer as an independent?
So, you know, I never know. It's what's interesting is after we sign an artist, it's inevitable that I hear the, as Doug Morris used to say to me, the chirpy birds, the gossipers. I had that. Oh, I could have done that. I had it for, you know, I told my boss, or you know, we let you have that one. Every one of my successes has been that way. I could care less. In fact, it really turns me off when someone says to me, you know, everybody wants us, or there's a bidding war. I've walked away in every case except one. We've been in one bidding war in our company. We won it, by the way. And what's sad about it is we overpaid and nothing actually changed. The essence was we loved the band. Mm. And all we did was give them a bigger advance because we were forced into it by two majors. So I'm happy we have the band, but it was an unnecessary thing because we pay the band and the band's profitable. So they never had to do that. We wasted 6 months of going back and forth. But other than that, I usually don't know about the competition because I tell the manager and the lawyer, no need to tell us.
Yeah.
And if you really need to go somewhere else, you don't belong here. Number two, you asked me, the majors, I think, do have an edge in the world of radio. I think particularly in America, they've built a lot of pop radio infrastructure in a good way. And I think if you really have a pop record, if you really have a novelty record, if you have a YouTube star that wants to cross over, I think you belong with a major. And I think, I'm not saying that in a cynical way or in a condescending way. I think you belong there. They're built for that. And they could quickly get you those 150 radio stations. But it's like a match. You know, the match is the incandescent flame. It goes up and then it goes out. We stoke the little embers. You know, we blow on it. We blow on it. We blow on it. We fan the flame until we have the bonfire. People say, when did that become a bonfire? So I think the majors do a spectacular job. And I love pop music. Not for Glasnost, but I love those pop records. And I think they just know how to blow them up quicker. And I admire them for that button they have and the relationships they have with the heads of these radio chains. Because for the most part around the world, it's become very top-heavy with the big guys in the radio chains are making the big decisions. It's not as regional and local anymore. Sad commentary, but they figured it out. And it's very powerful radio once again.
It remains so powerful.
It's always been powerful in my mind. I mean, the cynics and the pundits have poo-pooed radio for the last 15 years, but I've never seen more discussion about radio since the launch of Beats One. Mm-hmm. It's raised everybody's game, and it's radio, radio, radio. Something I've been preaching forever. I don't think you can get to the O2 and the Albert Hall and the places without radio. Even the Grateful Dead had radio hits with Clive Davis and solidified you. And then the bands people think didn't have radio, James Taylor, Prince, Neil Young, Carole King, smash hits. Paul Simon, Elton, they had a lot of top 40 hits, tons of them. So I think radio is more powerful than ever. I think that, again, what Beats One has done worldwide, everyone's had a wake-up call, and everyone's sharpening their blades and becoming better and better and better. So I love radio, and I think it's a great exposure. But I also think the streaming services are huge radio stations, mm-hmm. which is why I've been a fan of Spotify, a fan of Pandora, a fan of Sirius XM, a fan of what Bob Pittman does at iHeartRadio. I love Six Radio in London. I listen to Triple J all the time. I listen to KCRW. I listen to KEXP. I listen to WFUV, The Current, WXPN. You know, these are great worldwide. So to me, I don't really care if you're internet, if you're satellite, if you're cable, if you're online. It's radio, radio, radio.
And are you feeling confident about the future of your old friend Zayn and Beats One's efforts?
Nobody's working harder. You know, it's people always say to me, who's the most successful artist besides being talented? The hardest working artist. Mm-hmm. I don't think Zayn has slept in 3 months. This guy is working hard. He's delivering a show which is so superb. I mean, you could feel the preparation. You could feel the entertainment. You feel the discovery. And we're talking about him today, the fact that we're here. Ebro's show has been great. Julie's show has been great. I don't even know her, by the way. I've never met her. And I think her show has been great. So there, but you've got to hear the Sirius XM shows lately. They're amazing. You know, it's just great radio that's going on right now, and everyone's up in their game. And I'm sure Radio 1 is probably working a few extra hours this week, and that's good. I got to give Apple a lot of credit. I think they're doing a great job.
Well, you said you set up Glasnost with two Macs, so you are heavily reliant on Apple. And it looks like the industry is becoming heavily reliant on Apple once again. Are you feeling optimistic about the future of a commercial industry that relies so heavily on streaming and particularly on Apple Music?
It happened. You know, these conversations, if it happened, we're in a streaming world. The reason that people are still scratching their chin is that we're living with four formats right now, which is very unusual in any media. Mm-hmm. You've got vinyl thriving and growing. CD business is not going away. You've got downloads, and you've got a great download store in iTunes, which is not going away. And then you've got streaming, which is booming, booming, booming. So that's an unusual four-headed monster that's out there. We love streaming, and we're getting paid. You know, we presented two gold records to two artists last year, and you should have seen their faces. One was Churches, and two was Childish Gambino. And both looked at me when we presented the gold records, and our little mock ceremony was like, we went gold? I said, yeah, because the streaming numbers were so heavy. In addition to the sales, and they combined that, they said, wow, we actually have gold on the way to platinum. So we get paid, they get paid, they see their checks, their eyeballs are like, wow. And Sound Exchange, we get paid on performances with Sirius XM. So I think it's healthy. I think it's great. And it continues day after day, our catalog. It keeps moving, moving, moving. Mm-hmm. Where it's deceptive is on these quick hit releases that go up the charts and down the charts and then go away, oh, streaming is the worst. For our bands, it continues. Every day, it sells, and it helps ticket sales. It helps merchandise sales. It just helps perpetuate and helps it grow. So I see it all positives. There's going to be winners. There's going to be some people not making it. Mm-hmm. And I think Spotify's in a great shape, and I think that Apple's in great shape. And then we'll see in a few months when an iPhone comes out with, you know, that front page and Beats One is in there and the store is in there and streaming's in there. It's going to be pretty great.
What about the artists who perhaps haven't had the best time from Spotify, etc.?
They should make better records. I think they have to focus on their music. You know, I've never complained about technology. I sat in those meetings when we segued from vinyl to cassette to 8-track to CD. And to me, when the music is great, I don't think Taylor Swift's having a hard time. Okay, I don't think that Churches are having a hard time. Mumford & Sons are not having a hard time. Childish Gambino had an amazing year. You make great records, and they sell, and they stream. So I've navigated the Apple Music stores and ecosystem of Connect and everything. It's a dream, mm-hmm. if you know how to use it. So if I was an artist and I knew how to work Connect, I'm looking at that. It combines everything that Twitter or Tumblr or Facebook has if you know how to use it. When that masses up, what a place to communicate with your fans. So it's like going to an HMV or a tower in the old days and saying, hi, come see me. I got everything here. I'll give you a photo. I'll give you lyrics. I'll give you a little preview, or I'll give you a clip of my show. Everything's in there. I think it's fantastic. I am not one of those people that complains, whatever it is. Napster opened up the faucet and people try to close it and it's here. Mm-hmm. So I think you make great music, you're going to do great.
Sounds like Glassnight artists are okay.
Yeah, I mean, we've had clarifications. Artists have asked us,
yeah,
how are we going to get paid from Pandora? How do we get paid from Sirius XM? We're very open about it. We walk them through it. And our distributor's been great of showing us. Universal's done a very good job in the tech world of showing us how things work, getting us, you know, a good, favorable explanation or rate. And I have never seen a complaint from a Glassnote artist yet. So it's been fine.
I wanted to go back over your career slightly and ask you, what do you think your proudest moment is? But also, what do you think your biggest mistake is?
I think proudest moments, you know, we all have number ones. I think number ones are great. There's been some satisfying moments. The Grammys, to me, are very, very important. And I hope we'll win, you know, we'll be in the Brits and be nominated, you know, in the next 2 years. And the Mercurys, I think those are very important. But when we won, and Phoenix won the Grammy for their album, Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix, when I saw Childish Gambino last year sitting in the fifth row, nominated for his album because of the internet, when Mumford & Sons collected the album of the year, an independent record with an independent label, you know, I cried. And that's a great moment. Being on Saturday Night Live, a great moment. But I would say the Grammys, sitting there with the wins, it's very, very satisfying. It's beautiful. As far as mistakes and things I regret, I would think in the last 8 years, a few great pop records have come across my desk and into our company. And I passed on them for a lot of creative reasons. And I guess I'm sitting here today wishing, you know, that I would have grabbed one or two of those because they sold millions and millions of copies. It would have been nice to have those. You know, I was so, I don't know if I was a snob. I don't know what I was. But I think there's a, regret's a weird word, but I think those were mistakes. of the trade, where I think we could have taken one or two of those, and we would have done really well. Because, you know, the managers were great, the lawyers were great, but I said, no, that's not who we are. I hope one of them comes back so I can do that and have some fun. But I would say that's a thing I regret. I didn't take two or three plane rides to see artists when I think they wanted just to see me. And I think that would have consummated one or two deals. But you can't be everywhere. You know, I saw Mo Austin at breakfast today, and I think he's perhaps the greatest record executive. I didn't say owner, record executive. Mm-hmm. And he said something to me once, years ago, when I had left, when SBK had sold. And I said, you know, Mo, you know, what's it all about? And he said to me, go home and have dinner with your wife and kids. That's what's important. You're great at what you do, but go home and see your wife and kids and get that done. And he said, don't chain smoke planes, because when Prince and Madonna and Michael Stipe, he rattled off these names, Lindsey Buckingham, he said, when they call, they want to know that Papa is behind the desk and show up for them. Don't be where you have artists that you haven't even gotten yet. And Terry Ellis and Chris Wright used to say the same thing. Don't worry about what you don't have. Be sure you know about it, because that's bad if you don't know about it. But take care of your own. So know about it, but don't worry about it. Take care of what you have. So I think as I'm getting older, I'm realizing they want Papa to be there. And if you come around Glassnote, you will see my wife and three kids and my son-in-law every show, everywhere. Last night at Flo Morrissey. Mm-hmm. So it's a family company, not as a contrived thing. We are family. You know, I wouldn't sign an artist that I wouldn't want to have over the house for lunch or dinner. I don't need the record that badly. We don't need the money that badly. So that's part of it, is it's family. And I get to know their family. You know, Flo's parents were there last night. And I've gotten to know, you know, Gambino's sister. And I look at our roster, and I know everybody in Mumford & Sons. I just came from Ben Lovett's wedding. Deborah and I went there. And, you know, we're family. And it's great. They call me Uncle Danny. They don't call me Daniel. I'm Uncle Danny to these guys. And it is an extension of family. My travel doesn't consist of my lounge chair and which beach I'm going to hit. It's going to be which festival can I see, to go to Verona to see Mumford & Sons, or to go to Ireland to see Two Door Cinema Club, or to go to Australia to see The Temper Trap. That, to me, is the greatest thing in the world.
It would be remiss of me not to ask you a question, especially about Mumford's. When did you first come across them? What's your memory of first seeing them live? And were there any other record executives in the room?
I'll go backwards. There were no record. Again, I'm blind to that. So if they were there, I wouldn't see them.
Yeah.
I don't think there were any record executives in the room. I really heard about them from The Temper Trap, a band we've done very well with. And the lead singer in particular, Dougie Mandavi, told me about this band that had opened for them in Australia. And they were our mates, and they loved them. So they were playing a show at the Mercury Lounge, The Temper Trap, and asked Mumford & Sons to open for them again. So, yeah, I was in New York in this room, and somewhere between 15 and 20 people are in the room, and I was about to go down to the dressing room to see Temper Trap, and The Temper Trap pushed me to say, stay here on the main floor, because you really got to see them. And I said, well, I'd feel better if I was seeing you. I said, no, go see them. And they were just pretty awesome that night. And the passion of that show. And the band handed me this CD of five songs, which were part of this EP they were making. And then I said, this can't be that. It's like, the magic was so great. I flew to London to see the same pairing at the Roundhouse 4 or 5 days later. And it was, again, Mumford & Sons opening for The Temper Trap at the Roundhouse. And it was another great night. And that was the night Adam Tudhope was the manager, and I just shook hands and we made a deal, and it was very simple. No negotiation, it was very, very simple. And that was it. It was the passion. It was their talent. It was their look. It was their joie de vivre. And I knew this band wanted to be one of the biggest live bands in the world. People constantly ask, you know, what was the marketing plan? There was one line in the marketing plan: get people to see them live. That was it. So the success, particularly in North America, was getting people to see them live, their joy of playing, their passion for playing, and then getting them on the radio. That has been a very important factor, is that the band allowed us to bring the records to radio, and they've become a core alternative band with a kick drum, with a banjo, and now with loud electric guitars mm-hmm. and big drums. So they're amazing people.
They're one of your most successful recorded acts, but Glassnote Entertainment Group isn't just records. Seen a lot of activity this year around the publishing side of the business. How's that going? And again, what are your ambitions for that division of the company?
So it's been, the dream when I talked about Chrysalis and Chrysalis Music Publishing and learning what I've learned from Chris Wright and Terry Ellis, looking at Almo Music, which Jerry Moss and Herb built, and looking at that Rondor and Almo and those great writers and the synergies. SBK was a great example of SBK writers and SBK artists working together. So I love songs. My first job when I DJed to make a little bit more money was as a publisher. So the last year, I look at the success of Holy Child as a writing act, you know, seeing them get the Apple Watch commercial, which we cried when we saw it because we watched Tim Cook at the WWDC play it and was like, wow. And then we heard Panama Wedding on an HTC commercial, Peter Kirk. We have a record by Andrea Faustini coming, written by Johnny Wright. There's an artist named Parson James coming out with a smash that was just recorded of a Rory Andrews song. And I'm like pinching myself. That has nothing to do with Glassnote Records at all. And between Ed Poston and Sharon Tapper and, you know, what Jenna and Laura and Mark are doing, it's a phenomenal company. And we publish some of the artists that we have on the record label. It's not a prerequisite at all, but it's great. And I spend a couple hours a day on the writers, you know, with everybody. And it's great.
This is the final question, I suppose. It will hopefully become something of a motif for the podcast. But you've mentioned some of the great people you've worked with and indeed the way that they've inspired the very structure of Glassnote. When you look back over your career, who really stands out as inspirational figures that you've either worked with or seen from afar?
So as a DJ, I worked for a great woman who, you know, could have been a Holocaust victim, but she survived the war and became the most important club owner in the world, sort of the Coco Chanel of the discotheque era, named Regine. And she was my first boss when I was in college as a DJ. Legendary figure. Then I worked for a legend named Sam Weiss, who has had the most important one-stop import-export in the world, was also an R&B record legend, and I married his daughter. I would then say my time at Chrysalis, you know, I became very close to Chris Wright, who I'm still very close to, and it's been a great ride with him. I made it my business to get to know Mo Austin. I made it my business to get to know Chris Blackwell. I mean, I would have breakfast at Chris's apartment once a month before I started Glassnote, and as I was starting it, and he put the jam on the toast for me. He gave me that strong tea that he brought back from Jamaica. I never drank the rum. I still haven't tasted his rum. But the lessons, and I was in school, and he liked our first few artists. Then I noticed he was a little bit more embracing when I played him Phoenix. And then when I played him Mumford & Sons, he goes, now that would have been an island. And this morning at breakfast in front of Sam Rumney, I said to Mo Austin, I pointed at Flo Morrissey. I said, that's a Mo Austin Warner Brothers act. Vintage, you know, 70s, 80s. So I would say those, you know, I don't know if I mentioned Jerry Moss earlier in the interview. You know, before I signed the deal with Lucian Grange, I'll talk about him in a second, but I went to see Jerry as like Yoda. Jerry, what do I do? And he gave me my last bits of advice about international. And he's been a great mentor. First of all, I love the way he lives mm-hmm. with his racehorses, you know. And he's friendly with everybody. I mean, Sting is like his best friend. So, you know, when I can go out with those artists, and that's my extended family, I love that. So I love Jerry. I think he's just great. And Jerry Moss used to work with Sam Weiss. Jerry did promotion for my wife's father. So it comes full circle. And Shep Gordon, Supermensch, by the way, did the introduction. Who else would have done the introduction? And then, you know, Lucian Grange has Lucian was our publisher when I worked with Sam. And I knew him at Polydor. His brother and I had such success together with Sinead O'Connor, the Waterboys, World Party. And to be with a friend your whole career, a music guy, and then he's the chairman of the biggest company in the world, and he's a friend and a mensch. So to be in business with your friend is like the greatest. So I would say that, you know, he's been a real help. I think those are the guys. Berry Gordy, I stalked the guy. I mean, I just asked him one question. He gave me an answer that I didn't expect because I wanted to talk about the politics and the lyrics of some Temptations and Martha and the Vandellas records. And he said to me, it was about the groove and the beat. And then the lyrics came, and then the melodies came, but you had to get them on the beat. So I sit with our A&R people and I say, great, you got that. Let's get the beat going. Let's get the groove going. And when I worked for Sam Weiss, you know, he was a white Jewish guy from the Bronx, and if his shoulders and funkiness was not moving, because his lens was R&B and doo-wop. So that's what I measure things. So I have an R&B lens, an R&B dance lens. Everything to me I listen to with that. I don't tell everybody that, but that's what I do because I learn from those guys. But what doesn't change is the song, the passion and belief. And I'll go back to one word you used today, radio. So we love old media. We love radio. We love the exposure and love what's happening today.
Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the MBW podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
Thanks once again to our supporter, CI, and our friends at Tune Tribe Entertainment Group, who host the podcast. We'll be back in September.